I'm just excited to get to the films.
Me too. You know what? I love films.
Yeah. I enjoy films.
Oh, wow. Well, that's...
Yeah.
We should probably talk about films instead of what we were going to then.
Oh, no. Mike Gatting's cricketing career.
Yeah, I know it's very in vogue, but...
Everyone's talking about Gatting.
All the kids on the... they're on the Gat daily.
Oopsie, Gatting's trending again.
I never understand this generation.
I'll just throw out my notes for gabbing about Gatting and we can get into whatever the fuck this is going to be. Welcome to One Good Thing, the podcast that is best watched alongside Quest Fantastic. That's right, have yourself a once good tastic thingheimer.
Harbin Bibin.
I'm Paul Barbie.
I'm Bab Deb Badoo.
Bab Damn there, motherfucker.
Paul to the good.
That's right. We're here to shoot from the hip and do some straight talking. About the absolutely astounding year that was 2023.
Cunt! What a year!
Oh, Jesus Christ, what a year. One of the most exciting years of films I've probably lived through so far.
My hemorrhoids, they're bleeding. What a year.
What an absolute state of a year.
Just, like, what a fucking horrific Tetsuo of a year. By which I mean lots of good films. Many, many good films.
So
Jesus Christ.
Many good films. And an interesting year as well. Stale old stalwarts failed. That was a weirdly alliterative concept.
Yeah.
While some very exciting and disruptive newcomers became surprise sleeper hits.
Ooh.
Yep.
You're big on the alliteration today.
Yeah. Disney had a bad year.
Yeah.
I saw a bloke get a handy in a multiplex. It was an extraordinary year.
That bloke was me.
And I saw it, folks. It happened, definitely.
You should watch your own handies, listeners.
It was during Oppenheimer. And was tremendously disrespectful to the Japanese people. Even more so than that stupid movie. And I already feel like we are living in the afterglow right now. This year, very few superhero movies and legacy sequels. Well, fewer. I mean, I've already... Both of the films I saw last week were legacy sequels. So, but fewer. Very but fewer.
Back in yesteryear, that would have been three films instead of two. Two
that
and a half
been
if you're lucky.
If this was 2019, I'd still be in them now. And I feel like that represents progress.
And I think with progress, you've got to take it where you get it.
Absolutely. Just like your cinema-based handies. And consequently, this is the strongest that I felt about my top 10 list, probably since the pandemic. Mm. And perhaps my favorite list that I've presented to you, the listening public, whilst we've been doing this podcast.
I feel the same, and I was tentative about saying something like that in case you would accuse me of recency bias, and then everything
would
have come out.
Well, there's always that.
But it feels like it, because if I were to list my honor, there are some years that I don't even mention my honorable mentions because I feel like I'll be watching watching the clock and going, and now I've got enough movies to justify a top 30. Which has happened once, maybe twice, but this year, I think up to sort of 44. I'd been happy with any of them in my top four, top 30, in my top 43. I think I'd be happy with them all in my top 43, and I'll say that gladly.
Absolutely.
But yeah, just
it's wonderful.
A couple of sort of ripping documentaries that I didn't put in the top 30, which I on other years would have, but I saw this as a good a good excuse to just mention them at the top of the episode to allow more just classic cinema into the main episodes. Really, really astounding stuff. I just can't, like, there was a period there where everywhere we turned for a month solid, I think, just astounding film after astounding film.
It was. And, you know, as usual, we've waited the customary third of the new year to catch up and get some, you know, get some of the movies that are delayed due to overseas releases.
Yeah.
The clogging in that big movie pipe that they pump all the films through from Hollywood and elsewhere.
All the way from. Yeah, I feel extra tired this year, I think, after trying to do that. It was worth it, but I am tired.
Yeah. We are all tired, and that's what you're going to get the benefit of today. Last year, I admitted that I hadn't seen The Eternal Daughter and Showing Up before giving the list. I have now seen them, and do indeed believe they would have made my list, because they're both absolutely astounding. As would other excellent 2022 films that weren't even on my list, like The Blue Caftan, Under the Fig Trees, Return to Seoul, and The Eight Mountains. It's the delayed thing.
Of course,
and were I less of a twat, I would absolutely include them in my thing. It's just, you know what
but
it is
you're not
now?
That.
The letterboxed list. They put the year underneath. And so you'll have my favourite movies of 2023 and a couple of twos in there. And I can feel society and time judging me.
I think I'm glad that you're the one that's taking the brunt of that, because as you will see, one of those movies that you've listed as 2022 is in my 2023 top 10. But I am able to justify it because Australia refuses to release anything the year that it comes out for fear that it gets too cool and too big and we have to take it down a notch.
Oh no!
Yeah, I know.
It's actually beautiful. It's very much the same rationale behind everyone being made to wear school uniforms. This way no one can be cool and trendy.
But some kids still manage it, and I fucking hate them.
They've tied their shirt in an interesting way.
I never thought
Damn
of
it.
Doing that.
No! It's a toxic environment that I'm glad I never have to consider again. This year, the big ones that I didn't manage to get around to were The Delinquents, Rotting in the Sun, Hitman, and The Beast.
Hitman doesn't
very conspicuously
come out for doesn't come out here until June.
None of these do. None of these have release dates yet, but they are nevertheless.
I see.
2023 films. That's why I haven't been able to. Well, The Delinquents is out, actually. I could have tried to, but it's very long, and I came down to the last week. So decisions had to be made. Bad decisions.
Yeah, we were scheduling with the Quest Fantastic crew, and you said, well, if we get to record The Beach this week, that gives me an extra week to watch films for the 2023 list. And I wrote out a reply and deleted it, because it was going to say, I'm not doing that. Just I'd hit peak.
Well, look, yes, you mentioned honorable mentions. Let's do a few of those, because we will do, as usual, our 30 for 11 before we get to number one. But I actually have a top 50 this year. It's been ridiculous, and I'm not going to list all of them, but some of the highlights from the 20 entries that won't be in the main episode this week are Eileen, Theatre Camp, Polite Society, Evil Does Not Exist, Red Rooms, The Iron Claw, the Royal Hotel, and La Chimera. Also, I just watched El Conde today and really enjoyed it.
Yeah, so it was fun, wasn't it?
It was good. I liked it. It was really good, and I liked the reveal.
Yeah, I know. Just I spent the whole film going, that narrator sounds familiar. just so playful
really
and feisty
it.
And angry at the same time. Brilliant.
Very good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Honorable mentions on my side. There's a bit of overlap.
Oh.
I finally got around to Alcaraz because it came out here. Priscilla,
Yay.
The Iron Claw, They Cloned Tyrone, How to Have Sex, Hidden Blade, which was a real surprise. It was intelligent and withholding, and just looked very lovely and cool. In terms of documentaries, we've got Beyond Utopia and 20 Days in Mariupol, both.
Oh, yeah.
Just profoundly crushing in their own way, and 20 Days in Mariupol, I feel, is just it's a must watch. It's extremely distressing, but it is one of the most important docos that I've seen ever. And then back to movies, the Royal Hotel and The Holdovers didn't quite sneak into my top 30, and geez, they were so good.
Yeah, this is all testament to how incredible this year is, because any like the eight movies, I think I just listed there, maybe nine with like Chimera, El Conde, could easily be a top 10 in another year. Like they could just constitute a top 10 and of themselves. It's just that's the kind of year it's been.
Kept coming and kept coming, much unlike myself.
It just kept coming. Yeah, it's been a while. Let's get right into it, mate.
Okay.
Before there's another bloody strike. Uh-oh. So, Paul, you 2020 the...
Hello, I'm 2023, Paul.
What's your first bloody film, you wonker?
Me number ton is Return to Seoul, mate. You're the film...
Seoul.
Seoul.
Seoul. Or as the locals... As the locals say, Seoul.
Seoul around these parts. Confusing people, the inhabitants of Seoul, South Korea.
Yeah, it's very much what the film's about.
C'est ta mère? Biologique, je pense, ouais. Tu vas essayer de retrouver tes parents? Pourquoi non?
David Chow, or Cho, is the director. Story is a 25-year-old French woman returns to Korea for the first time, having been adopted by French parents. In trying to track down her parents, her journey of self-discovery may turn out to be more profound in the end. This feels like a very... It feels like a very quiet journey of self-discovery. The overarching story really takes on a feel of the epic, like this delayed coming-of-age story that needs to make up for lost time. She goes on this journey, meets people, and her sort of outgoing Western ways, you know, quickly make her friends because it's much easier to break those sort of social barriers in this way. But the trappings of this homeland that she... wasn't sort of a part of in her youth, but is sort of being told that she has to embrace at the same time, holding her back in a way, and sort of not giving her the epiphany she was hoping for. Park Ji Min as Freddie is such an interesting, captivating performance because she's got so much restraint and guardedness, but also frustration with this world of Korea, of familial responsibility and societal expectations, with some really painful, awkward scenes with her her estranged family, who immediately start trying to get her to, you know, get into an arranged marriage and you know, just give up everything that, you know, she may have taken for granted in her home country of France. And you can sort of feel this pressure pushing on her, but she's a really forceful, strong, bold person. And this sort of laconic but very firm pushback, it just makes this really beautiful little quiet film that gives you these intense, shocking moments. But all the while remaining quiet, this sort of quietly heartbreaking film with no easy answers. But it's just so powerful. It's one of the first 2023 quote unquote movies that I saw, and it's stuck with me ever since. You know, a really surprising turn of events. Just makes it such a watch that's worth a watch.
Yeah, no, it's extraordinary. I love the evocation of South Korea. Freddie's a terrifying character in so many ways. She's so untethered, you know, potentially as a result of the lack of sort of family ties, but also just because she hasn't really found herself yet. Very much like Rey in The Last Jedi. She's
Skywalker.
Yeah. She's put too much emphasis in the idea of family in that second film before she realizes she was correct to do so in the third film. And has yet to discover that she needs to discover her own values that won't come from necessarily a family unit, but instead from within. And as a result, she ends up, you know, just as an arms dealer for a bit. And that's just part of the journey we're all on. I love that, though. I love that about her, that she was so unpredictable. And that you had no idea where her story might go.
So surprising, that ending. I spent the whole few scenes just sort of reeling and trying to reconcile with it, but it just felt more perfect for it.
Yeah, absolutely.
No easy answers.
Ceci, tout ceci est ma terre d'âme.
Votre mère est arrivée.
Well, speaking of a lone woman trying to make her way in the world and making some bad decisions and ending up in some pretty shitty terms of employment, my number 10 is Do Not Expect Too Much from The End of the World.
Vă prezint o producție de Hollywood prezentată de Leu de la Metro Goldwyn Mayer.
Right. I couldn't see because Australia.
Oh, because Australia, damn it. This is Radu Jude's epic comedy film that follows a day in the life of a put-upon woman named Angela, played brilliantly by Linka Manalucci. I'm going to suggest her name might be pronounced, as she goes about trying to... she's Romanian, so I'm not entirely familiar with the rules, but I'm going to go with it. As she goes about trying to recruit a suitably photogenic victim of an industrial accident for a health and safety video being assembled by the ad company she works for as a runner. Along the way, she has various adventures, meeting some eccentric characters, including Uwe Boll, playing himself. She meets various people who have been involved in the real-life 1981 movie Angela Merge Me Departe, a gorgeous-looking Romanian film about a female cab driver in Bucharest. And there are scenes of that sort of spliced in. And of course, she films these horrific TikTok videos of herself, which, in which she uses a filter to look like Andrew Tate and espouses these satirical, misogynistic views. And she rationalizes.
Oh, is he that?
That behavior is he good?
That like, sorry, yeah, is he that like, like teenage boys motivational speaker? Martial artist.
All I would say is just savor not knowing who he is. It's a wonderful thing, and I would not wish even a preliminary Google on my worst enemy, so just enjoy that.
Yeah, I think I read about him the other week.
He's horrible, and hopefully he'll be going to prison soon.
Good. Okay.
But yeah, the whole thing culminates in this extraordinary single stationary shot that comprises the second part and nearly sort of final third of the film as they actually shoot this highly immoral safety video. But this is the first Radu Jude film I've seen after Missing Bad Luck Banging or Loony Porn a few years ago. But I do want to see everything now. This is an incredibly funny, devastatingly well-observed, and entirely singular kind of film in its in terms of its form. Most of the film is black and white, and he likes to sort of lock down on his actors. But there's just so much stylistic experimentation going on to keep things fresh and exciting. And yet it's very natural. Cool. It's very natural as well. Manalache is charismatic and warmly tragic and is supported by an excellent supporting cast from Nina Hoss in a brief cameo, which is very fun. And yeah, just very natural performances from the actors playing the workers she meets, who may actually be authentically just sort of people that Radu Jude has met. I'm not sure. He might have gone Gaspar Noé on this. But it's a savage critique of the gig economy and meaningless media jobs that manages to feel both pointless and exploitative. Like, if anyone actually ever watched this project she's trying to put together, it would be really bad for them. So let's just hope that it's as pointless as it seems. The film poses the haunting and just darkly comic suggestion that perhaps we shouldn't expect too much from the end of the world. Maybe it already happened and we just didn't notice and we're still going about our business anyway.
Probably spot on.
Yeah, it's very good. I loved it a lot.
Amazing. Yeah, would love to have seen it. And maybe, it'll feature in my 2025 top 30.
Fuck yeah, look out for it.
Woo, Australia.
Just f*** off.
Yeah, and f*** you also.
Yeah.
And f***
you.
Totally.
My number 9 is your number 6.
Oh, God. I'll have to read the stuff I've got for my number 9. I have so much to say about it. Okay. So many of the films this year came from filmmakers potentially nearing the end of their extraordinary careers, not to be too bleak. Lots of films that represent the sort of apotheosis of all of the filmmakers' style, technique, and thematic concerns. And indeed, it's not the only one I'll talk about today. But of these, my favourite is Martin Scorsese's Killers of a Flower Moon.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you got nice color skin. What color would you say that is?
My color.
The Osage. They have the worst land possible. But they outsmarted everybody.
The land had oil on it. Black gold. Money flows freely here now.
I do love that money, sir.
In It's the real-life story of the systemic exploitation and annihilation of the Osage people at the hands of white authority figures. The film follows Ernest Burkhart, Leonardo DiCaprio, as he marries and begins the process of gradually murdering his wealthy wife, his wealthy Osage wife, Molly, played by Lily Gladstone, as well as other crimes for his uncle, the crime boss William King Hale, played by Robert De Niro. So, as a brief rundown, Scorsese has always concerned himself with the angry, power-hungry loner. Found a natural bedfellow in Paul Schrader, who's also obsessed with this, although perhaps potentially a little more, what's the word, without variation, a little more single-mindedly.
Broodily doggedly.
Yes, indeed. Scorsese's vision of this man has evolved a little, but together they both created Travis Bickle with De Niro. A violent outsider full of rage in a world that doesn't respect him enough and that he perceives as corrupted and his to solve. Now, as Scorsese's career progresses, he offers tragic echoes of this character in Rupert Pupkin from King of Comedy, Jake LaMotta from Raging Bull, and Henry Hill from Goodfellas. But as times moved on and Scorsese perceived his America as getting more cynical and worse, he started to find these dangerous men in places of power. Think of Howard Hughes, Jordan Belfort. And then the motherfuckers made Travis Bickle president. And so Flowers of a Killer Moon very much feels like Scorsese's post-Trump movie. A searing portrait of corrupted Americana. Yeah, Robert De Niro's William Hale is a monster, and the most compelling monster I think De Niro may have ever played. He's terrifying, but comes at you with this warmth to the extent that some sick part of you actually wants to believe him, even as the evidence of his crimes that play out in broad daylight become just more and more obvious. Everyone can see what's being done here. Everybody suspects what's being done here. And yet everyone is powerless to stop it and maybe even disbelieve it just because of how audacious what is happening is. It's the mundanity of evil on a truly terrifying scale.
Yeah, I definitely had that effect. It had that effect on me as an audience member, thinking, it's gonna pan out.
They can't possibly just be doing this, can they? It's just,
No.
Lily Gladstone is just monumental as the long-suffering Molly. The script is absolutely focused on her would-be killers, but her performance refuses to be defined by the suffering inflicted upon her. She's Titanic in the role. And then supporting roles from Jesse Plemons, Cara Jade Myers, and Tatanka Means. That seems like an autocorrect. I'm going to say Tatanka Means. To name just a few, a few of these people, they really create a world together and create an impression of a compelling stories that beginning and ending all around this narrative that you just want to look beyond. And of course, De Niro, DiCaprio is... just confusing. Astounding. It's just astounding as this absolute wretch of a human being. His
craven wretch is
the golem of his career.
In my head, I think. That's horrendous. So horrible to watch. Just the ickiest feeling.
But I say, wanting to look outside of the frame. Speaking of that frame, this is one of Scorsese's most breathtakingly ambitious films stylistically. He and cinematographer Rodrigo Prieto achieve this epic Western aesthetic that looks extraordinary on the big screen. Thelma Schoonmaker edits with all the energy that she's been bringing to these projects for the past 40 years of their collaboration now. Sequences in this, like the dream sequences, the gorgeous afterlife sequence that really gets me every time, and most spectacularly, the scene with the crops burning, are just amongst Scorsese's best. And then finish it off with Robbie Robertson's haunting score, and you have a film that is not a eulogy to a filmmaker who may be reaching the end of his career, but an exciting and terrible work that any filmmaker would be extraordinarily gifted to have managed at any stage of their career. It's just staggering.
Absolutely. Well, I feel like Scorsese did that with Hugo, and then he's like, okay, I can go back to just doing... Oh, and then he went, oh, wait, The Irishman. And it's back to just making things that get him riled up.
A couple of times maybe he's been pigeonholed a couple of times. Like, if you look at sort of something like Goodfellas, then Casino, and then The Irishman, there's definitely through lines here and a sort of expectation from him. But there's always an angle. There's always something different and poignant that he's always striving to achieve something different and bring something new to the screen. And I've no doubt that his second Jesus movie is going to be an entirely new and tremendous thing from his Passion of the Christ. So yeah, Passion God. Of Christ? Temptation of Christ.
Whatever.
Oh dear.
He also did Silence, right? So it's
he did?
Jesus yeah. trilogy. The oh, Silence. God.
Can't wait for the Prince Charles Jesus trilogy that will take place over a day.
Wow. Well, watch out for that, everyone.
I can't imagine the Jesus movie is going to be very short.
They never are.
Never are. Okay. What's your number eight then?
My number eight is Godzilla minus one.
Godzilla minus one. So
is that, does it make it number nine? Post-war Japan is at its lowest point when out of the nuclear fallout arises Godzilla. Some humans run about and have emotionally resonant and profoundly beautiful moments together on screen for us.
Yeah.
I did write that. Jeez. All right.
I love it.
As mentioned in the Godzilla Kong episode, this was the first Japanese Godzilla movie I saw ever. Mm. I've seen two more since. Don't worry. I'm going to be okay.
It's getting
but
there.
What a Godzilla movie. I'd been totally ruined by American Godzillas and the low bar that they had set over the course yeah. of many, many years of, hey, oh, yeah. it's smashy, smashy CGI. What the fuck do you want? The American army wins. And you know, and I didn't realize that these movies had the potential not only for competence, but for flair and outright ripping my heart out yeah. and sticking with me for a long time after. Mm. I can't wait to watch this film again because it's, for one thing, it fucking looks amazing.
Yes.
It looks so good. It captures the aesthetic of sort of post-war depression really well in the way that the best period pieces do, but it is so emotionally sophisticated that the main character, I wrote this down, I don't know why I haven't gotten it here anymore. I know Sakura Ando is in it because
yeah.
she's also in one of my other top 10 features.
Amazing.
Ryonosuke Kamiki as Koichi Shikishima is just he carries all of this trauma with him of survivor's guilt and the sort of the death of an empire on his shoulders as this sort of this kamikaze pilot who never got to carry out his final mission or his only mission, but also didn't want to.
Yeah.
You know, surprise, shock, horror, and. He wears this through the ensuing tragedy and destruction that Gojira wreaks on Tokyo, and it is heartbreaking to watch him cope with that in the way that he does by shutting out everyone and ostracizing himself in plain sight. It is just so emotionally intelligent and hit me almost immediately. So to do that along with this film that looks so good with, you know, Oscar winning visual effects, combined with the score, which, you know, I know now is the Godzilla leitmotifs, which feels so grand. And with the, I thought of Nolan a lot with the aerial, all the aerial combat, the dogfighting shots, a lot of the sort of on the wing shots, I think, and it just... It had that kind of scale to it that makes my mouth water. It's the fact that it manages to just feel so human whilst also being a thoroughly unabashed spectacle. Has changed the way I think about Godzilla and, you know, has put me on a course to definitely eventually watch all of the Japanese ones. What a movie.
As well you should, as all should. Wonderful. Yes, I'll talk a little about Godzilla later on, but excellent.
Godzilla minus one.
Oh, but my number eight, I'm not going to talk about at all, actually, because it's one of yours.
Because it's shit.
Yeah.
Imagine.
So instead, you're going to have to tell me about your number seven.
All right. Well, that's Across the Spider-Verse, mate. So get ready.
Buckle yourselves in, lads.
I like it. Boys.
This is the one I like.
Oh, good.
He wants to go out into the world and do great big things.
Not bad, kid.
And what I worry about most.
I love you, Miles.
Is they won't look out for you like us.
Miles!
Want to get out of here?
Miles Morales must navigate adolescence and family whilst also entering the multiverse to prevent its very destruction. But many, many spider people have differing ideas on how to handle it. It's good. So it's good. Weird. It feels like treading a familiar path, coming here and talking about a Spider-Verse film with bold, fluid, original feeling animation, wonderful vocal performances, a killer soundtrack, etc., etc. And kind of it is, because I have exactly the same things to praise this time around. But Across the Spider-Verse manages to take all of these things that its predecessor does so very well, either further or, you know, honing and sculpting, or in a new direction entirely. Honestly, sometimes the animation feels like it's freestyle, like anything could happen at any moment. And the best thing is, with this movie, it just might. Something is going to surprise you within the next 2 seconds. Whether that's a quiet reaction, a facial expression, a sight gag, an amazing line. Who knows, but something is going to happen. The way this movie shifts, like the way the animation shifts depending on which character you're with and what's happening, is so exciting. A lot of the time it happens without you even being aware of it, and the same goes for the music, but you know it's happening. You can just feel things shifting constantly, and that adaptability of the animation, which is something which is so strictly coordinated, is quite a feat. And, you know, the music with Gwen Stacy, there's a punkier vibe in there along with the hip hop that feels great. And you know, you get that sense as well that it feels very important with Daniel Kaluuya's character, Hobie. Yeah. Just that anarchic anti-establishment energy in it, which, again, you know, in an animated Hollywood movie, albeit, just feels so... It gets the blood pumping, and I love it. Other than that, the characters feel real as ever, and the conversational dynamic is always so thoroughly natural, thanks in part to the writers, thanks in part to the voice actors, of course, to name but a few: Shameik Moore, Hayley Steinfeld, Brian Tyree Henry, Luna Lauren Velez. The list goes on and on and on, but to mention some new additions, Jason Schwartzman as Spot is brilliant. Issa Rae as Jessica Drew is so funny, and Oscar Isaac is terrifying. Shea Whigham as Gwen's dad is heartbreaking. But the animation does so much of the heavy lifting as well. Just, as I said, these little expressions and reactions that make every second of this so fun through and through. Yeah. It's also just goofy. It's goofy as all heck, mate. And I love how seamlessly it shifts between this and serious to that emotional core, which is just as sophisticated as the previous movie, whilst also upping the stakes. And the silly and the serious feed off each other. And it's not afraid to wear its emotions on its sleeve, tackling everything from love and friendship to parenting, growing up and growing apart. And of course, you could argue that most films cover this, but this film's ability to do all of this whilst being an exciting and hilarious action-packed comedy about a spider person just elevates it to one of the most exciting and lovable films of the year.
Absolutely.
You gotta promise, Miles.
I promise.
Who do you think you are, really?
We are supposed to be the good guys.
We are.
Fantastic. Yeah, I'll have a little to say about that in a little bit. A little to say about a lot of things in a little bit.
Uh-oh.
But for now, we'll get to my number
That's
seven.
A threat.
Now, 2023 saw some truly amazing British films get made, more of which we shall discuss in my 30 to 11 list. But I think the best of these, well, second best of these, is Molly Manning Walker's How to Have Sex.
Oof.
Best holiday ever!
What's your name?
Tara.
I've not noticed it before, but you're proper beautiful.
You two are two of my best mates.
Gang, gang, gang.
No one cares if you're a virgin, it's very chill, so why are you bringing it up then?
Tara,
lads.
Tara, Em, and Skye are three 16-year-old girls who are on holiday in Crete. And their plans are to forget about their exams, eat cheesy chips, drink a lot, go clubbing, and have sex. An intimidating prospect for Tara, the only virgin of the group. And as the nights go on and they encounter various other boys and groups, Tara starts to get pushed out of her comfort zone and potentially into the way of danger.
Yeah.
Or is she? Yeah, definitely. This is Walker's debut as a feature film director, but she has an incredibly prolific career as a cinematographer, writer, and director of shorts, and the cinematographer of also excellent, also this year, Scrapper, another great British film of 2023. And perhaps this helps to account for how assured her debut is. The film is, of course, pure anxiety for me, as even the happy parts are my idea of actual hell. But I am reliably informed that the film captures all of the worst parts of an uninhibited party holiday.
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly what I imagined Ibiza to be like.
Yeah. For worse and for worse. Mia McKenna-Bruce is the very deserved winner of last year's BAFTA Rising Star Award, and she is fantastic in this as the kind of character who would typically be a supporting or background role in somebody else's film. McKenna-Bruce and Walker explore this the complex inner life of someone desperately trying to fit in with her extrovert friends by pretending to be shallower than she is. She's not the nerd. She's struggling at school. She's unsure of her place, less confident than she is pretending to be, and terrified of being exposed as less mature than all of her friends. And it's an anxiety-inducing film that does go to some very dark places, but it does so with a deafness of tone that avoids becoming too morose or in any way exploitative of what's happening. It's a very urgent film.
Or sensationalist.
Or sensationalist. It's a very urgent film about consent and sex that's told with a responsible but exciting sort of youthful energy that should articulate so many anxieties for so many young people. Anxieties that I remember and which surely are only mounting further in the age of social media, but it will do so in a way that hopefully will be exciting for young people to watch and not sort of,
didactical.
Indeed. The closest thing I can compare it to is Lynn Ramsey's Morven Collar. And for me, this film bespeaks the same promise that that did. It's an expertly crafted, immaculately well-timed, and perfectly pitched kind of drama thriller. It may be a tough sell, but it's absolutely irresistible once you're into it. It'll stay with you, and not in a bad way, because beyond the devastating but sensitively handled rough stuff in the film, it's a film about the friendship between these girls and about the sort of strength that you can find within yourself. You know, it's the friendship between them is inelegant, naive, but endlessly sincere, like all teenage friendships. And this is a wonderful portrayal of that.
Yeah, and it has a couple of very surprising, just very surprising moments. And I don't mean in a terrible upsetting way. I think I went into this very anxious as well, and it was a couple of moments of just of realistic humanity. That were sort of these brief, like, you know, ports.
Yeah,
brief storm ports.
The final scene is just a real tonic for everything that's come before.
Oh, God, yeah.
It's a tremendous relief and a beautiful thing that I think is, going to be relatable for a lot of people who have had terrible experiences and just want to and find fellowship, you know, afterwards.
Yeah, and there's the scene sort of in the middle when she sort of disappears, but, you know, just meets some really lovely people.
Oh, yeah. Yes, of course.
Who take care of her.
Yeah.
Oh, just... I wasn't expecting it because the trailer kind of sets that moment up as she goes, she disappears, and something terrible happens. But it's just human, and you know, and the other side of being human, and it's a really, really good, exciting, and sort of promising start.
Yeah. Fabulous. But mate, what about your number six? Is that all of those things too?
It definitely is, but I daren't talk about it because the man won't let me. And by man, I mean you, because I think it's your number three.
Oh, shit. Well, that's authority figures for you, especially when they're me. Yeah. All right, then. I'll talk about my number six. I know I bloody have to, because, my number six is Justine Triet's Anatomy of a Fall.
I just want you to know one thing. I'm not a monster.
I need you to be precise. Tell me everything.
Yes.
Woof!
Eek! A man falls.
Anatomy of a Fall.
A war. A man falls to his death in his isolated chalet in the French mountains. His wife claims to have been asleep in the office downstairs as it happened, and his visually impaired son was out walking his guide dog. Did he fall? Did he jump? Or was he pushed? Only time and a surprisingly hot lawyer shall tell. So.
He is French, so.
Yeah, he's French, it's true. You wait for a movie like this. It's from its opening scenes that beautifully draw out the moments before the inciting incident, set to the devastatingly catchy soundtrack of a steel drum cover of Pimp. You just know immediately that this is going to be a beautifully paced, character-driven, highly stylish drama that's going to keep you on the hook for the entire thing. The death at the center doesn't have too much in the way of twists and turns, sort of forensically, in terms of like mechanics or little things coming up. The revelations instead coming not from forensic detail, but rather the exposure of the central relationship to the scrutiny of a sort of judgmental world, all asking the tantalizing question, if exposed to deep interrogation, could you definitely prove that you're not planning to murder any given person in your life?
Yeah.
Haven't you at some stage had an argument with them?
The results are surprising.
Or mentioned that you'd like to kill them to a friend? Or had a murder weapon lying around? Isn't that just everyone you know?
It isn't.
Uh-oh. So much is unearthed through this conceit. Questions of gender, of nationality, of parenthood, you know, of modern work. It's a movie that anyone who's ever tried to make a life work with someone else will be able to bitterly relate to. And weird loners like myself shall find very vindicating. So, we can all
stay the course.
Enough of this bullshit, just get the dog. Sandra Hüller is absolutely outstanding as Sandra Voiter, who is, it turns, just fragile and then also coolly assertive. Unknowable and yet deeply relatable. As we, the audience, are invited to partake in exactly the process she is railing against, you know. She's a deliberately frustrating character sometimes who's elusive because that's the point. You know, you can never know someone else, and it doesn't mean necessarily you get the right to judge them. It's almost a deconstruction of our true crime obsession, forcing you to confront the unknowability of the truth and the impossibility of pinning any one person down as being any one thing.
That might be why it felt so refreshing.
Absolutely, except for the prosecution lawyer, who is a monster. The prosecution lawyer is, and everything that's wrong with our society.
The prosecution lawyer is just everyone, the villain that everyone sees and knows exists, regardless of where you're from.
But yeah, otherwise, nobody is any one thing. But for all that deconstruction, it just works so brilliantly as a thriller and a courtroom drama with lots of reveals and shifts and tense moments, and the mounting of some of the trial sequences are just stunning in screenplay and directorial execution. It's fabulous. Yeah. It's a really brilliant film that I can see myself returning to many times.
Yeah, I adore this. This is my number nine. I just remember the sheer, like, the thrill of the confusion that I felt over how easily something could be interpreted to suit both prosecution and defense.
Yeah.
And how fluid and dangerous that felt. And I remember, you know, finishing this movie just wanting more, you know, which in this case was a great sign, a mark of something that was truly compelling, and knew that it was dangling something just out of reach. And even though that it wasn't the point, finished the movie with hands over my face.
Yeah.
wanting to scream. I love this movie. It was so good.
It was extremely good.
I'm innocent, you know that, right?
Ah, right. Well, what's your number five?
Your number two or one?
Oh, no. Whoops. Well, hang on a minute. My number five is your number something.
Oh my God, I'm so confused. I can't remember where my notes are.
Are we ever going to talk about another movie again? What was your number four?
This is one of you. Wait. No, my number five?
Yeah. Yeah. Five.
Oh. Yeah. No. Yeah, no. You already asked me about five. It's one of yours. My number four.
Yes.
Okay. Oh, phew. My number four.
Okay.
My number four is mine and mine alone. I don't think it was even in your top 50.
It's mine. It's mine. Right. No, that's the voice. Yes. Ari Aster.
Ari Aster.
You know and love him. You know and love him. And
yeah,
he's a nice boy. He's good to his mum, or he isn't, or the other
he
way.
He might
around,
really
I'm
not
sure.
be, mate.
Yeah. Or it's hard to tell. But his latest film, Beau Is Afraid.
I am so sorry for what your daddy passed down to you. But I wanted a child. The greatest gift of my life.
I'm visiting my mother tomorrow.
Taking aspects of Hereditary and Midsommar for sure, but this film feeling very much a very different film. Very. Beau, played by Joaquin Phoenix, is due to travel home to visit his mother. But everything he fears will happen does for 3 hours. This is catastrophizing the movie. I don't know how this goes down to the neurotypical among us, but this film is about a man with crippling anxiety and self-sacrifice issues, and it made me feel very good and very heard, which I wasn't expecting from the guy who made Hereditary and Midsommar, and to be honest, wasn't expecting having seen the trailer of it for this. In a sense, you know, it is a very different energy in one sense, whilst also retaining much of his style, a certain look and feel, an eye for the grotesque and confronting. This world inhabited by Beau is a worst case scenario version of our world. Where he lives, blade wielding skinheads chase you down the street towards your home. Heading over the road to the grocery store is more likely to get you infected by septic crackheads or brutalized by a local serial killer, who, by the way, the news likes to remind us in TV, newspapers, and billboards, is on the loose just around the corner from where you live. And people will hammer on your door at 2 a.m, accusing you of things you are clearly not responsible for, and will literally fucking murder you if you don't stop. Danger is around every corner, and Beau is responsible for everything, and he is so, so sorry. So when he takes a call from his mum and his odyssey begins, it gets even more ludicrous and horrific. But the more it does, and the meaner it becomes towards the titular hero, Beau, the more it seems, to me at least, to come from a place of affection from Ari Aster. Mm. Whatever Ari Aster's reasons for making this film, it feels to me like someone who knows mental health struggles intimately, and the overlap between my own mind and his, or those he portrays, which are an extreme version of mine, make this movie something I can laugh at, and like giggle even, like a Gollum with a fish, I wrote. So because as I say, it's something I know so well. How to describe the tone? The scenes in Hereditary of Toni Collette screaming and running about whilst terrible things burst out of walls and that. It's just that again and again and again. Joaquin Phoenix is a fucking chameleon and quite special in the lead role. Nathan Lane supporting is just rolling around with his balls out and having the time of his life. And so is everyone. I really hope they did.
Yeah.
From beginning to end, it's a movie stuffed with detail and these strange, ponderous scenes. I know Ari Aster has lamented that the runtime and mixed reviews dissuaded a lot of moviegoers from taking a risk and engaging because he put so much detail in every shot. But, you know, that's always a risk, especially when you make a 3-hour movie about anxiety. But for my part, I knew all of these things so intimately. I feel like if I were to read a BuzzFeed listicle about everything that Ari Aster shoved, fisted into this movie, I'd just go, oh yeah, I know, I picked that up immediately because this is something that I know, something that I live. And yeah, I just can't get over how much all of this resonated with me. It's something I sort of have a philosophical acceptance of, and to see that reflected so well and so literally in this in this film was truly remarkable. I really appreciate this movie on an emotional sort of therapeutic but also technical level. It's very, very impressed with it, and I can't wait to watch it again and sort of dig in further.
Amazing. Fantastic. Mm. Good stuff.
Yeah.
Good old Harry Astor.
Oh, Harry Astor.
Harry Astor, he's done it again, isn't he?
Oh, he's done it again. He's put his mum in a box.
Your adventures will continue for years and years.
As soon as you get home.
I know.
And I'll tell you else he's done it again. That's Tran Ang Hung, director of apparently some very good films, although his only other film I've seen is Norwegian Wood.
Mm.
Nevertheless, here he is, directing this historical romance movie that I'm just scanning to see if I name in a minute or if I should do a big reveal here. I don't! The Taste of Things!
She's going to tell me how some. She was in the set and she was in the merveilles sur le feu.
Nous passons plus de temps ensemble que bien des époux.
Je vous le demande encore, Eugénie. Marion.
Combien de fois encore allez-vous me poser cette question?
Yes. A French film.
A French. The French film. Yes, a talented cook, played by Juliette Binoche, works for a fine gourmand, played by Benoît Magimel, in late 19th century France. But French!
French dressing.
A beautiful French. Everything. By day, they prepare food for each other, and at night, they conduct an occasional informal romantic relationship. Aww. Although the gourmand, Dodin, wishes for more. But will he get it? Who's to say? That hot lawyer I mentioned before. There are a few twists and turns, but the bulk of the movie is spent just soaking in this seductively elegant situation that they've crafted. Set mostly within the richly detailed kitchen of the country estate, the sounds of the French countryside always audible just outside the always open door, as the hazy summer light just streams in. We enjoy lovingly captured French cooking as the two express their deep, almost unspoken love for each other through their craft. They're careful but zesty art, engaged with passionately but with great care. The cinematography and sound are crucial to fully immersing you into this scenario. There's a great deal of quiet and very stately longing going on, but with enough warmth and sex to ensure the experience is always more indulgent than it is melancholy. Even when the narrative turns to death and grief, there's always a dish to be prepared and just a piece of light to be embraced, or an art to dedicate oneself to anew in the morning. Binoche is reliably brilliant in her sort of elegant beauty and gravitas. And Magimel is just divine. A very joyful antithesis to the tiresome cliche of the troubled genius with no social skills. He's a quiet man, certainly, who keeps himself to himself for the most part. And, but he's also deeply compassionate, whose deep devotion to his craft comes at no expense to the warmth that he exudes. And the strength of one of my favorite... the effect is that he is one of my favorite characters of the year, and an exceptionally authentic sort of chemistry exists between him and Binoche, which may well stem from their real life relationship that they had many, many decades ago, and then didn't speak until they came together for this film, which might account for some of that palpable depth to the sort of relationship between them.
How interesting.
There's also a philosophy of food at play. A lengthy episode and subplot within the film is devoted to a prince who invites Dodin to his estate to overwhelm him with a decadent meal he has prepared in order to impress this great gourmand. And Dodin, in return, plans his response in just the most beautiful way that he could, a most wonderful way of responding to this prince and his gesture that I won't spoil here. But there is... Okay. There's a divine canon of movies about food. Movies that deify those capable of instinctively crafting sumptuous dishes that articulate smell and taste for a purely visual and audio medium. And the audio is crucial here. Every crunch of a chopped vegetable, every sizzle of meat pressed against cast iron. And this film is a worthy entry into that canon and just a beautiful and soulful place that I will enjoy returning to.
C'est à son le meilleur moment de la journée.
Yeah, I can't wait to have access to that here in Australia.
Yeah.
In the meantime, I'll just keep stealing lemons.
The land of gourmand. What's your number three?
My number three. Oscar bait, a piece of shit, a white man's favorite film, Oppenheimer.
Oppenheimer!
By Christopher Nolan.
This is a national emergency.
Detonator charged.
We're in a race against the Nazis, and I know what it means. If the Nazis have a bomb.
God, I was very excited all throughout award season as Oppenheimer. The story of the eponymous Robert J. and his role in the development of the atomic bomb.
Robert J.
Scooped up plaudit after plaudit, feeling the same weird pride as I did when the rest of the world became aware of Peep Show actor Olivia Colman. Everyone realised she was amazing. Everyone already knows how we feel about Nolan already, so I don't need to go into detail on why this is such a joy. So I'll just talk about Oppenheimer instead. Again, we're not the only people who marvel at Nolan's ability to take heady or complex subjects and condense or translate them into visually stunning, blistering blockbusters that also manage to be exciting, edge-of-your-seat action fare, even when depicting two people sitting at a table slapping their butts, whilst also not forgetting to prioritise cinematography and practical effects. Many other people have said as much. Denis Villeneuve, Christopher Nolan, us. And Oppenheimer is the apotheosis of this. It's not an action film by any stretch. It's nonetheless paced like a thriller. In fact, after writing this, I checked on Wikipedia and it's described as an epic biographical thriller. So there you go. Me and Wikipedia, we're tight. Yes, Cillian Murphy stars as Oppenheimer. And he's just got this haunted look about him, tackling these, you know, demons and political prejudice whilst simultaneously leading the US side's race towards nuclear armament. But the story of his unofficial trial at his security hearing and Senate confirmation hearing for Louis Strauss, or Stross, played by Robert Downey Jr., are enmeshed in this utterly singular film, almost as if the ebb and flow of favour and scapegoating is institutional and everywhere, all of the time. This ability of Nolan sets this retelling apart on its own, but God, there's more. Hoyt van Hoytema's stunning, dumbfounding cinematography, filming with IMAX black and white film for the first time ever. Ludwig Göransson's mesmerizing score is one of the standouts for me. It just feels so fresh and also in freeform again with its use of vibrato and glissando. And then can you hear the music employing these tempo shifts that just reflect the frayed, chaotic brilliance in Oppenheimer's mind, with all of its torment and genius just crashing again and again to shore, as well as, you know, telling us about these wider stakes and the threat. It's one of Ludwig Göransson's best, and it's perfect for this film. And God, you know, we could talk about the practical effects, the work that went into just building, composing these shots of, you know, of both Oppenheimer's mind and its inner workings, and also just the devastation of you know, these atomic blasts. The use of sound and silence and just space in general is so important here, and it's just another string in this bow of this all-round stellar film. And yeah, as I said, Cillian Murphy is fantastic, just haunted and self-assured and cocky and troubled, a mess of a man held together by this march towards understanding but also his wife, played by Emily Blunt, who is just oozes charm and has some really powerful moments later in the film. And just the supporting cast to die for as ever, but including Matt Damon, Macon Blair, David Krumholtz, to name a couple of people who probably wouldn't usually get a mention, but are always, you know, always fantastic. You know, so many more. And all the while, I'm just carried along by this sense of awe that Nolan always succeeds in giving me. This sense of wonder at those things in life that are so much bigger than us. And also left feeling icky by some of those things too. Those man-made systems and processes that can commend and condemn in the same breath.
Yeah,
it's a very good film, Oppenheimer.
It is. It's my number five. And yeah, just an extraordinary film that really demonstrates that the big screen, sort of high budget entertainment needn't solely be the preserve of the family film or the sort of mediocre kind of action fare. It can be a wonderful means of exploring some very complex ideas and very profound use of sort of imagery and sound in a way that is truly overwhelming. And it's wonderful that so many people came and saw this. I hope that will translate into them maybe taking more risks in their cinema viewing, but they might just... If not, then Christopher Nolan's just going to have to start slapping his name on things as executive producer. So far, just Man of Steel. Yeah. Uh-oh.
Whoops.
Oh, dear. Do better than that. But I'm sure that Sir Christopher will use his powers responsibly, and the next fucking film he makes is going to be whatever the hell he wants. He's going to get the very blankest of checks from this, and that's a fairly exciting possibility.
Yeah.
At least more exciting than Michael Bay having that privilege 20 years ago.
Which he has just for being alive.
He sure does.
You are the man who gave them the power to destroy themselves. And the world is not prepared.
Truman needs to know what's next.
Two.
What's next?
One.
My number three, speaking of heavily qualified appreciations of movies, is All of Us Strangers.
Was it Mom and Dad?
Yeah. They died just before I was 12.
I'm trying to write about them at the moment.
How's it going?
Strangely.
Hi.
Yes.
Yeah, another melancholy romance from me. Yeah. Oh, look, the straight guy likes the movie about the tragic gays. Why do you hate gay joy so much? I'm sorry.
It makes me feel inadequate, all right?
I just need them to be as unhappy as me. Then I can accept everyone.
It's true equality.
The story follows Adam. Played by Andrew Scott, as he struggles with isolation in a seemingly empty London high-rise. A chance encounter with another loner, Harry, played by Paul Mescal, sends him on a journey into the past, where he encounters the ghosts of his dead parents, played by Jamie Bell and Claire Foy. What will bring it all together? Power of love, innit?
Wow. Oh, okay. Yeah. I guess that's fine.
As Frankie Goes to Hollywood. This is an adaptation of the Japanese novel Strangers by Taichi Yamada. And it certainly has that morose kind of just natural acceptance of the other side that is so familiar from Japanese cinema. It's a melancholy ghost story set in a high rise, but has a very classical kind of feel to it. It feels like Kureneko or Kwaiden.
Yeah, and more so than it does high rise.
Potentially, although there was that bit with Tom Hiddleston. There's just a lot to relate to about this film, from the isolation of modern urban living. The freakout sequence in the tube is terrifying and something that I've been thinking about a lot since. To the desperate need to reach out and back in order to make peace with people who have slipped out of reach. It's a really deeply personal film for Hay, a return to the thematic concerns of his earlier film Weekend, and he even filmed parts of it in his own childhood home. So it's a deeply personal story about love, longing, memory, and death. But it's not bleak. It's gorgeous and moving and funny and well-observed and unbearably tender. The sequences where he opens up to his parents and is rewarded with all the tenderness that he never found whilst they were alive are devastating. Yeah. And although the ending may play into certain tropes, it feels incredibly necessary to the overall message of the film, which is our relationships are not valued by their duration, nor are our lives.
Yeah.
And the ending may be a fantasy or madness, but it's beautiful and deeply hopeful in spite of everything, which is very profound. Performances from the four leads are subtle but fully lived in. You believe and recognize each of them instantly, and you can just slip into the dynamics and feel as though you've known these characters for years. The chemistry between all of them are just incredible, and the uncontrived detail in their manners and speech speaks to the authenticity of this experience. It's my favorite of things. It's an entirely fantastical exploration of a painfully real aspect of all of our lives, and I love it for its poetry, its style, and its showcasing of captivating performances. It's the most affecting and beautiful drama of the year for me.
Fantastic. It just felt so real. Like a soft and squishy inside part of me, these beautiful moments of quiet, gentle moments of compassion, and a film that caused me to take a step outside myself and to look inwards at my own relationships with parents and friends, and just looking at me and my processes with the compassion that this sort of this fantastical, yes, tragic, but also profoundly beautiful film encourages you to is really, really special. And Andrew Scott and Paul Mescal and Claire Foy and Jamie Bell are stunning and real.
And the chemistry between Scott and Mescal as well, and then the sort of love sequences between them are just really profoundly affecting and very sort of very exciting as well. So that's good stuff.
Yeah.
I think he'd like to be in love with him.
I'd always fall in love. This is a new feeling.
You and me together. Into the world.
That was my number five as well.
Ooh!
Mm.
That's what you put in your Oppenheimer slot. I refer to all of your slots by what I put in mine.
That's fair.
What have you got in your zone of interest slot? Oh, shit!
Uh-oh!
Uh-oh, spoilers!
Oh, it's actually Moonlight. So, Koreeda. Hirokazu Koreeda. His film, Monster.
Monster!
Jeebity crazy. A mother demands answers. A dead Easter guy. A mother demands answers from a teacher who appears to have hit her son. But questions are raised about the son's innocence, bringing more than just the two into the mix. And the more we learn, the more people are involved, the harder it becomes to pass who has hurt whom, let alone who's to blame. What? Now, in fact, seeking blame feels redundant after being treated to monster. Koreeda's latest demonstrates his strengths in full force. His pure, uncut ability to render believable and sympathetic characters and to express ideas so cleanly and clearly, so competently. Without wanting to say too much, it's a film that demands the viewer see a situation from multiple perspectives to appreciate the composite parts one by one. And it is so surprising just how in the director's palm I was for the duration. Yeah. And Koreeda makes it appear effortless. Just when I thought like I couldn't possibly care more about the current protagonist or care less about the other side, I'm blindsided and shown just what I bloody know about anything, which happens to be nothing. Like, the way my sympathies careened, rooting for people for which I previously felt nothing but disdain, was ceaselessly surprising. Monster invites you to make connections yourself. There's more than one heartbreaking moment as you realise why a character such as the son or the teacher you know, do a certain thing that another character finds outrageous or weird, we're led to find ridiculous. And every single time it broke my heart. It elicited that from my belly every single time. And these moments are not lingered on, but they're there, and they just cut swathes through the chaos of this need to blame or to reassure. And God, it's a film full of these moments. The cast is wonderful. Sakura Ando, who was also in Godzilla Minus One, was amazing. Is amazing in this. Eita Nagayama as the son Hori, and Soya Kurokawa as the classmate Minato are so good. They give such tender, beautiful performances. These young men, and you feel this inner child of unresolved questions coming out of Koreeda and the writer Yuji Sakamoto. And it just manages to feel so genuine, throughout, which is always it's a rare feat, I think, to have these scenes where the children are the only performers, to feel so genuine. It's just excellent work from everybody, and you know, everybody else is just fantastic and plays so well into this initially one-sided feel you get of a character that is then filled in and played with such compassion at all times. I think what Koreeda does best is create immensely watchable and beautiful films with robust emotional cores that cut through the chaos of daily existence. And that's what this film means to me. And finally, the score. Beautiful work from the late Ryuichi Sakamoto, that features this leitmotif of sorts. This you know, this blast of horns that's more reminiscent of Mika Levy or Yerskin Hendrix from Poor Things, which is tied into one of the most affecting scenes of the movie, one of the most affecting scenes for me for all of the movies of 2023, and it is so satisfying when you figure out what this piece, this blast of horns signifies. And what it means to one of the characters whom I hated at the beginning of the movie.
Oh no.
But felt nothing but frustration for, you know, this person. And it pins the whole thing together. We're dealing with a lot of people who are dealing with hurt, expectations and duty, who are constricted by society, by what is expected by their peers, and you know, the motion of a society towards blaming and scapegoating. And it's beautiful and kind and liberating to see it executed so brilliantly in this film by Koreeda. Just truly a master of work.
Yeah, absolutely. It's extraordinary to see his sort of ambition growing as he gets more resources, having spent so long making these incredibly beautiful, tender, family-driven dramas for the past 30 years.
100 years?
Well, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. He's always been there as a patron saint of Japanese cinema. And I can't wait to see.
I love him for it.
Where he goes with it.
Yeah, same.
Right, we're getting into it now.
Fuck all that bullshit.
Well, my top two films epitomize the difference I've always felt defines my two favorite cinematic experiences. Wonder and awe. The Spielbergian delight at the magic of the big screen and the sort of sense of adventure, and the Kubrickian overwhelming terror of the truly monumental. I've got one of each here. And I have
gone... You didn't tell me about this.
Well, I've gone for the childlike whimsical wonder as my number one this year, which leaves the awe-inspiring monumental film in second place. A borderline religious cinematic experience that comes like revelation. It's Jonathan Glazer's Zone of Interest.
My my number six, but on any other year, it could have been number one, I think.
1943, Auschwitz concentration camp is surrounded by the Zone of Interest, an area reserved solely for the SS and the administrative staff of the death camp. And here we find Rudolf Hoss, the commandant, living with in despicable peace with his wife Hedwig, played by Sandra Hüller, and his children. We see them living their lives, worrying about the garden, taking picnics, riding horses, being annoyed by the bozos at head office who don't know what they're doing, all whilst millions of people are tortured and murdered just behind the wall. Nothing within the film is explicit. The film has a 12A certificate here in the UK, and yet this is the most disturbing film I saw last year in many years.
Yeah.
Glazer's goal is plain to see. You'd have to be stupid to miss it. The audacity of it, to give us the perspective of the perpetrators, to completely demystify them and expose them not as monsters or cartoon characters, but as everyday people that you can relate to, even at their most indifferent and potentially cruel. You'd, of course, call it pertinent to the times, but when would this not be relevant? When are we not separated by the greatest evils in the world, by a narrow wall that we forge and maintain ourselves? Glazer's other goal is not to remove the characters from our own experiences by the sort of comforting distance of history. He wanted this to feel modern. He wanted it to feel like it was happening right now. And he accomplishes this with his fly-on-the-wall filming style, his very sort of modern acting techniques that he gets from his staff, and other sort of technical techniques, such as the use of infrared in the nighttime sequences. It's an extremely inventive film that utilizes experimental techniques and forms to explore a familiar atrocity in an entirely new way. Little quirks of innovation and just difference here are just terrifying in a most literal sense. Yeah. There are so many moments in this film that are entirely overwhelming and terrible in their implication. My second time watching it, I wept during the scene where Hedwig shows her mother the garden.
Yeah.
I was struck by the young boy replicating the drone of the industrial ovens, a wonderfully contrived moment by Glazer and sound engineer Johnny Byrne. The soundscapes of the film, including Mika Levy's minimalist score, are brutally effective and entirely haunting in a way that just stays with you. It's not a film to be engaged with lightly, but it is a monumental testament to the power of cinema and one of the most profound works of humanist cinema ever made.
But yeah, just a film that feels simply unreal. The Zone of Interest, feeling like a documentary about a normal man doing the most insane, incomprehensible thing. The score, the cinematography, the color palette, the constant droning and moaning, and just the opiate effect of the house on Sandra Hüller. And that scene with the mother coming to stay is one of the most horrific moments of the cinematic year, I think. Just so deeply unsettling. So
it really
unsettling.
Is. Right. Okay, well, I think we better very, 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 very quickly run down our 33.
There's one more very every year.
11. off you go. Do it, you prick. Do 30.
I'll fucking do it like a prick. 30, John Wick Chapter 4, directed by Chad Stahelski. More truly revolutionary action movie brilliance from Chad, Kanu, and a team of dedicated and very talented stunt people. Bigger and, in this case, better in many delightful ways.
Oh, thank you, Chad. 30. The Human Surge 3, Eduardo Williams' wildly experimental essayistic docudrama, explores the modern world as you've never seen it before. See it now in cinemas.
Go on.
Oh.
Okay. Number 29, Les Trois Mousquetaires, D'Artagnan, by Martin Bourbalon. Rollicking, well-executed actions, sexy intrigue, and charming sauciness. Come to the party. In, for my money, the best adaptation of Dumas' novel/serial to date. And yes, Milady is not out yet in Australia.
But have you seen the Michael York version with Oliver Reed? We
should. Oh, I daren't.
Oh, I daren't do it now. It's too sexy. Well, 29 for me is John Wick Chapter 4. The saga concludes for its most ambitious and extravagant entry. Exhilarating and a little moving, too, I think.
So do
Thanks, Chad.
Thanks, Chad. Number 28. Thanks, Chad. It's El Conde by Pablo Larraín. Anger manifests as ridicule. The best way, asks Solzhenitsyn in Pablo Larraín's latest, a horror fantasy biography of sorts of Augusto Pinochet that's belligerent and at times outrageous, but at all moments quite clear on the subject matter, leaving us with something that feels quite original.
It's quite original, Chad. I think. 28. Femme. Speaking of Chad, an absolutely gut-wrenching voyage into the dark heart of toxic masculinity that is terrifying, yep, not in what it portrays, but in the empathy it asks of you. George MacKay and Nathan Stewart Jarrett are extraordinary. It's also hot in a kinky kind of way.
Jesus.
Jesus, as are all of the entries in my list.
You swear by it. Number 27, Dream Scenario by Christopher Borgli. A really unsettling analogy for fame in the internet age, amongst other trauma-inducing phenomenon, with a Nick Cage performance for the ages.
For the ages. Ages 8 to 6. 8 to 6. Going backwards. 27, The End We Start From, speaking of going backwards, a sister film to Children of Men that sees a young, new mother struggle to survive an apocalyptic flood in Britain. Captivating, thrilling, and really quite beautiful.
Fantastic. Speaking of those, and Chad, 26, Barbie by Greta Gerwig, who achieves something really special, so compassionate and so human, hilarious and honest, refreshing and exciting, all in a day's work for Greta Gerwig and Noah Baumbach, Margot Robbie, Ryan Gosling, and more.
Thanks, Chad. 26, Thanks, The Chad. Sweet East. A youthfully energetic, surreal odyssey through modern Americana. A young woman runs away from a boring school vacation and has a grand, darkly comic adventure. Check it out.
Chat it out. Number 25, Past Lives. Longing and loss come to a head in Celine Song's romantic drama turned on its head. No easy answers, only compassion, quiet little moments with another human being, authentic performances, and impeccable portrayals of love and people in love. Gorgeous. Ooh.
Get in love. 25. Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. An endlessly charming coming-of-age comedy that focuses on a young half-Jewish girl trying to adjust to a move from New York City to the suburbs. It's very clever, sentimental without being cloying, and just incredibly funny.
Classic Chad experience. Number 24. Godland. Hilnur Parmesan. Sorry. Sobering treatise on life, existence, and death in the only... Fuck, I'm an idiot. In the only avian that matters, Scandin. Its bleakness, sparseness, and sheer gorgeousness exist in perfect symbiosis.
They sure do. Number 24, Reality. Sydney Sweeney proves that she is a force to be reckoned with in this stripped back but profoundly cinematic adaptation of the real transcript of the FBI interrogation of a former intelligence specialist who may have leaked information during the Trump administration. Incredible direction from Tina Sadler.
Number 23, Reality. Insanely tense and wrong-footing adaptation of the play of the real-life US national security event. Profoundly discomforting, surreal, and brilliantly played with Sydney Sweeney in the lead.
Yeah, absolutely. 23, Robot Dreams. Really sweet and animated comedy from Spanish filmmaker Pablo Berger about a New York populated by anthropomorphized animals. Dog seeks companionship, so orders a robot to be his friend. Really beautiful and surprisingly poignant film that plays without dialogue.
Yes, number 22, The End We Start From.
Oh!
Mahalia Bello. Apocalyptic floods hit the UK and a Jodie Comer travels back home with a newborn babe. From poverty and desperation to loss and willful forgetting, this is a beautifully shot and acted film about quiet moments of humanity amid a landscape of grief, and you would do well to see it, sir.
Oh! Well, I should bloody well get on doing that then in the past! I have back-to-back animation because at 22 is Hayao Miyazaki's triumphant return and possible exit, The Boy and the Heron. Another master filmmaker building upon their already monumental legacy with all the fantasy detail and scope that you would want from the best Ghibli films.
Nice. You can't get him out of that office, though. Number 21, Polite Society, wearing influences on its sleeve, but also very well indeed, plus a much-needed nod to stunt work through the ages. This British action film about a young woman saving her sister from a semi-arranged marriage ticks more than boxes, in my mind, by which I mean it's very good, very fun, and will stick in the old heart.
Kick those boxes. 21, Fallen Leaves. Falling just outside of my top 20 is the latest from Maki Kurosaki, and although it's very familiar story and mood for Kurosaki fans, he returns Ozu-like with another subtle variation on his subtly hilarious view of modern Finnish life.
Number 20, Robot Dreams by Pablo Berger. A lonely dog in 1980s New York builds a robot friend and finds his soulmate, but separated, they must find new meaning and purpose until they can be reunited. Heartbreaking and adorable, delightful and tragic, the detail and care in every single frame earns every emotion it pulls from you.
Damn right. Number 20, The Holdovers. Mm. Alexander Payne's tender 70s-inspired comedy drama feels like Hal Ashby and has all the character-driven humor and pathos you would want from a Christmas film. A career-best performance from Paul Giamatti, I think, and amazing roles from Davin Joy Randolph and Dominique Sessa.
Yeah. Oh, I've got back-to-back animations, because my number 19 is Hayao Miyazaki's The Boy and the Heron. Whimsy and nostalgia in full joyous force in Miyazaki's not last film about a boy who travels to a world shared by living and dead, perhaps in search of his mother, who knows? A film that balances dark with light, horror with melancholy with love, a film born from a boundless imagination.
All right, fine. Well, I'm going to stick with the quirky, character-driven, auteur-director comedy dramas then. My third in a row, what's wrong with me? Because I've got Asteroid City. One of my favourite Andersons, gorgeously designed, deeply personal, and fully possessed of that restrained melancholy that make his films so resonant.
Number 18. Oh, what's this? A quirky auteur-director? Killers of the Flower Moon by Martin Scorsese. Masterfully paced epic describing the murders of the Osage following... murders of the Osage following discovery of oil on...
Come on, man. Regroup.
Masterfully paced epic describing the murders of the Osage following discovery of oil on Osage Nation land and the struggle to bring even an investigation to being. Fantastic performances and direction make this worthy of acclaim, but the events themselves are what is brought into the light, and there they should remain.
My number 18 is Past Lives. Enough comedies that are also sad. I want a sad movie that's also funny. Celine Song's film is a really lovely romantic drama about a couple that never was. It's dramatic but entirely without melodrama, beautifully acted and delicately paced.
Lovely. Number 17, Napoleon. Delightfully weird and kinky biography of the French military leader come in emperor that doesn't skimp on style, scope or hard work and brings solid performances from its leads Joaquin Phoenix and particularly Vanessa Kirby.
Oh, yes. Number 17, Priscilla. Sofia Coppola's forte is the anguish of teenage girls whom she captures as these ethereal, troubled beings full of mystery, but always in trouble. And she knows the hollow sadness of being isolated and rich all too well as well. And this may be her masterpiece of sad girls and big houses. Amazing performance from Kaylee Spaney that spans decades with ease.
I prefer her masterpieces of sad girls in small houses.
They're out there too, folks.
There's one I can think. There's one. Number 16, Suzume. Makoto Shinkai's return to form for me with this tale of a 17-year-old girl whisked away on a quest to help close doors to the other side that are causing disasters across Japan. Visually impressive, constantly surprising in its wealth of ideas and observations. A film that leaves me smiling stupidly as though hugged every time.
Well, I'll have an animation too then. Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. Absolute unity of sound and image, exhilarating, youthful, just a beautiful portrait of youthful hope, doubt, opportunity, and pain. Miles and Gwen's stories are beautiful and affecting. It's the only lingering thread of a connection I have to superhero movies now. And I love it for that.
Fair. And I'm happy with that. 15, Fallen Leaves. Shot on film, the knackered, deflated Helsinki of Karasmaki's oeuvre nevertheless glows like a Tony Lungfield Hong Kong 1962 in this sweet little romantic comedy. It feels weird to call it that, but it is. That is brilliantly underplayed. Brilliantly. Funny and surprising. Not to be missed.
Absolutely, mate. It's spooky time because... Birth Rebirth, a twisted black comedy horror film about a... This is a scented candle. A twisted black comedy horror film about a socially awkward pathologist who has found a way to bring back the dead, specifically the dead daughter of her colleague, a maternity nurse. They uneasily work together to keep the undead child alive, but at what cost? Really funny reinvention of Frankenstein with women prominently in front of and behind the camera. Absolutely staggeringly well acted as well.
Nice. It's kind of like Replicas. Oh, what a finish.
It's a lot like Replicas.
Number 14, A Fire. Christian Petzold's movie about a struggling writer, Leon, who travels to his friend's holiday home to work, but he probably ought to work on himself. And I dare say nothing more. What a great surprise of a movie. Watch it!
Watch it! Number 14, Monster. Koreeda's brilliant work of empathy consistently challenges your assumptions and sympathies, forcing you to look wider and really see its characters for the first time. It's compelling and profoundly moving.
It is. Number 13, American Fiction. Such a brilliantly funny and painful movie from Cord Jefferson. Jeffrey Wright is incredible in this look at the black Oh, okay. Fuck me, I'm an idiot. Jeffrey Wright is incredible in this look at the black experience, quote-unquote, the story that ought to be told, the story that's told instead, and the day-to-day struggles of Wright's character that glow with such complexity, warmth, and realism that it achieved one very rare phenomenon for me. I laughed when they laughed. I found their conversations funny when they did.
Love that. Number 13, Godzilla Minus One, a reinvigoration of a 70-year-old giant monster, a peerless work of blockbuster cinema where the human drama is just as compelling as the action. And the action is extraordinary, amongst the finest monster movies ever made.
Yeah, number 12 is Poor Things by Yorgos Lanthimos. Simply gorgeous, unique-looking and sounding tale of Born Yesterday Bella, a constantly evolving and compassionate wonder with a career best from Emma Stone in the lead.
Well, my number 12 is Close Your Eyes, the seldom seen Victor Orife returns with another masterpiece of elegant, elegiac cinema that again represents the culmination of so many of the concerns of his career: cinema, nostalgia, memory, friendship, and identity. It feels like a newly unearthed masterpiece of 70s Spanish cinema. As you're watching it, it concerns a man who thinks he might have found an actor who disappeared from one of his films many, many years ago.
I really wanted to watch that. Expect it in my 2024 list.
It's on its way, folks. And our number 11s, we're going to fucking keep back, like sneaky pulls, so that you can find out more about those, including, you know, what they are, in the Patreon. They're cracking. They're both, I believe, movies that we have not discussed here so far. So,
very exciting.
Okay, folks, here we are. Let's talk about our favorite films of 2023. And the only time it's reasonable to do so, here on the 7th of April, 2024. Paul?
I love this day.
What was your favorite film of 2023?
Oh, mate. Matey, matey, mate. I have taken a poster, like one of the little like promotional leaflets from my local cinema, to frame it and put it on my wall.
Oh boy!
As a monument to, a totem of, and a reminder to live my life by the principles outlined within.
Yes.
Perfect days.
Perfect days.
Oh, it's such a Vinvenders perfect days.
Just a perfect day. Drink sangria in.
I've heard there's going to be a shared cinematic universe with Patterson, and that the main characters are going to get together and have a chill off.
To watch Madam Web.
It's going
to
be
thrilling. This really is an antithesis to both of our lives. Yeah, I know. In Wim Wenders' Perfect Days, Hirayama lives a life of routine. Waking early, he works as a toilet cleaner in Tokyo in the Shibuya district, driving from toilet to toilet in his van, listening to cassette tapes, enjoying a simple and quiet lunch in the same park, taking pictures of the light filtering through the leaves of trees, after which he visits the public baths, watches baseball sometimes at a local restaurant just off Shibuya Station, and waters his plants, lovingly rescued or rehomed from around the city, and reads in bed until he nods off. On weekends, he wakes later and naturally, develops his photos, picks up the previous week's photos, cleans his apartment, visits the same mama bar, and the week begins again. Yeah. When something breaks his routine, it reveals a little more about his past or Hirayama himself, but it's in the spirit of the film that it gives you only what you need to wonder. It has this episodic feeling while still clearly being framed in the wider story of his routine and the importance of it. And it's just this big, wonderful enigma that keeps you thinking, and wandering and falling in love with Hirayama himself. Routine as a word comes with connotations of banality and dreariness, and something we often try to escape, but Perfect Days recaptures the simple beauty in a routine. Hirayama, played by Koji Yakusho, goes about his work and play with mindfulness and awareness in repeating you know, the same basic movements, processes every day. He's alert to the smallest of changes in his surroundings because of how intimately he's come to know this routine. And it brings that same awareness out in the viewer. After being with him for just a couple of days, you know, I started to notice and wonder at these details. Why doesn't he take his watch from the shelf in the morning when he picks up his keys? Does he ever take all of the coins from his change bowl? Like the smallest things just become the biggest mysteries and things you demand to know the answers to in your heart. And you know that when he leaves the house in the morning, he looks up at the sky, except for the days when he's tired. And Koji Yakusho's Hirayama is fascinating. He's the loveliest looking man. With, you know, his sort of fluffy-ish graying hair, mustache, and his smile, yeah, and his eyes all coming together in this expression of someone who's quiet but alert, who has the confidence to speak only when necessary, but the empathy and compassion to see the beauty around him in nature and in other people, whom, you know, he previously had not thought all that much of. But it's hard not to be in awe of him and his world and the way he sees it, even though he clearly carries a lot of tragedy and sadness with him. Or does he? I don't know. The toilets are characters in their own right, you know, designed by Tadao, Ando and Shigeru Ban for tourism/social regeneration purposes. Each have a distinguishing factor and all offer something different, a different cleaning strategy, a different toilet user. Go find out for yourself. You won't be disappointed. You can even go on tours of these toilets now, which have, you know, thanks to this movie, these things, which I believe were designed, you know, with the potential Olympics that were to be happening, to be more accessible for tourists. But, you know, it didn't quite happen. I also believe this movie was initially intended to be a documentary, and then Wim Wenders found it. It came across his plate, and instead of eating it, he went, I can put this into something new, a new film in its own right. They lead to all these really wonderful, you know, sometimes shocking interactions. Music plays an integral part, as does reading, photography, and elements of poetry. Poetry is all around in this movie. Scenes where others interact with him are often around these things, with reactions ranging from wonder to mercenary. And because of his status as a toilet cleaner, Hirayama is subjected to a very firm shunning from certain people, which is so shocking, despite being quiet and underplayed. But in eschewing a lot of trappings of modern life, phones and internet and other technological advancements, by stripping his life back to a gentle, compassionate awareness, he's carved out his place in the world. Very much a niche, but it's a lifeline, and Wenders and Yakusho realize this in such a profoundly affecting way. It really can't be overstated how profoundly poetic this film is and the effect it has on me. Exploring the concept of komorebi, the light that filters through the trees that only happens in that moment and never will again, Hirayama takes this approach to life. You know, sure, things can be upsetting or trying right now, but right now is only right now. Next time is next time. And that chant of kondo wa, kondo ima wa, ima, is this mantra just is swirling around my mind, put so concisely and perfectly. And yeah. And recently in my life, I've been grasping blindly towards the similar realization, this desire to find solace in routine, eschewing screens and this sort of tapping into the wider world whenever I have the mental energy to do so. So Perfect Days really came at the perfect time.
Yeah.
Finally, you know, this appreciation of analog and the real world, as it were, it balances on these feelings of simplicity and nostalgia. Sort of appears as a result. It's presented in 4:3, 1:33:1, the aspect ratio, which gives it this gorgeous intimate feel, just like the listening to cassette tapes. It's a beautiful meditative piece on life, on reconciliation, aging, loss, recovery, existence, music, toilets, trees, and the now. But like komorebi, it might well mean something completely different for you, and that moment may just disappear in an instant. But I love this movie so very, very much. It's incredibly important to me, and I feel like it will be for a long, long time.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous film, and it was my number 8. And yeah, it can actually be quite confronting to be presented with sheer contentedness, especially when living a somewhat hectic life. It's an intimidating prospect to simply take joy in simple pleasures. And a fascinating film for Wim Wenders to have made at this stage in career, when so much of his recent output has been documentaries about various, you know, figures that take his interest, creative figures particularly, in films like Pino and Salt of the Earth and Ansel.
Yeah.
which came out this year, which in so many ways Anselm was autobiographical because it was about a German post-war artist, you know, working in a different field from him, but on a very similar subject. And that's the thing, is a lot of his most profound work of the 1970s was focused on the idea of discontent, of not being happy with the Germany as it existed, with the economic bubble and the German will to forget the war. So to have made this film now does bespeak an idea that perhaps Wenders is looking back with a sense of contentedness. And it's very curious to think, you know, if we would be able to busy ourselves with such a life. And it's a very beautiful prospect that's excellent to think about, to think about how we would build such a life.
It's an answer that I'd very actively been searching for.
Yeah.
So, watch this space as I fail to appear on this podcast ever again.
There will be a gorgeous canon of these kinds of movies, I think, which at the moment,
I think
I think also includes Patterson, but I shall have to have a thing.
Absolutely.
今度は今度. 今は今.
今は今.
All right. Well,
go on.
And so my number one, and as alluded to, I've gone for whimsy this time over The Monumental. It is the funniest, kinkiest, and weirdest studio movie of the year. It's somewhat studio. It is Yorgos Lanthimos's Poor Things.
This is Bella.
Bella,
this is Mr. McCandles.
Hello, Bella.
No! She's an experiment.
Good evening.
Her brain and her body are not quite synchronized. But she is progressing at an accelerated pace.
Tell me, where did she come from?
I shall. For it is a happy tale.
Yeah.
It's very good.
It's really good. Emma Bloody Stone plays Bella Baxter, the bizarre creation of mad scientist Godwin Baxter, played by Willem Dafoe. God raises her in academic interest, but also in paternal love. But his plans are disrupted by the rakish Duncan Wedderburn, played by Mark Ruffalo, who provides Bella with the means of escape into a strange and exciting alternative Victorian world where she may find her fortune and forge her destiny and identity. It's an episodic and epic tale of discovery that on first viewing has you wondering what could possibly happen next. And then on repeat viewings just yields more and more delight at how perfectly crafted this journey of discovery is.
Yeah.
Leading through hedonism, curiosity, education, cynicism, self-reliance, cynicism again, and then perhaps the chance at contentedness, but only at the expense of innocence and some pain, although not necessarily all hers. Robbie Ryan's innovative cinematography captures the astounding production design by Shona Heath and James Price with iconic costumes by Holly Waddington. I read that Bram Stoker's Dracula, the Francis Ford Coppola film, was a key sort of note on how to shoot and plan the production, and that's not a surprise because it has a similar sort of sumptuous, not quite of its age, but not quite identifiable as any other age feel to it. A very sort of singular feel to its look.
I watched that for the first time recently as well.
Well, there you go.
There you go.
Add in Jerskine Fendrick's bizarre and occasionally Nyman-esque score, and you have a very unique aesthetic and stylistic experience. It looks and sounds like nothing you've seen before. And then you've just got the performances. The heart of the film is it's an extremely character-driven. I mean, it's just a character-focused narrative. That just puts its characters into different environments in order to see how they bounce off the walls. Lanthimos has always had this brilliantly funny way with characterization and dialogue, a sort of awkward Wes Anderson-style stiffness that is very off-putting, disconcerting, and funny. But the favourite saw him evolve this manner of performance, and in Poor Things we have its apex. It's unnatural and yet very authentic.
Yeah,
they feel like whole people. They're just strange and slightly different people. It's funny but beautiful and very sincere. The way things are put in a way that is poetic, in its simplicity. Emma Stone gives what feels like a brand new performance. She's drawing on a century of Frankenstein monsters and finds an entirely new way of delivering it. She's mesmerizing, entirely compelling, even when she's despicable. Just you become obsessed with her.
Yeah.
I can't talk about every performance in the film because everyone's just wonderful, but Willem Dafoe just becomes more beautiful every time I see this. His moments with her near the end of the film are overwhelming.
Yeah.
Because it's an overwhelming film. It's everything I hope for from a cinematic experience, all of the life.
Yeah.
Just lusciously and ludicrously rendered on the big screen. And it works brilliantly with an audience, but will hold up to sort of private viewing as well. It's, yeah, just everything you could want, all wrapped up in a ridiculous package.
Such a beautiful fantasy of the set design and the sort of just the surrealist perspectives of some of the city shots, or I think of Alexandria as well. Just that one image of that hotel on the top of that cliff, it just will stick in my mind, along with Mark Ruffalo walking onto the dance floor. But just unendingly imaginative, and as you say, never seen anything like it.
No.
I feel so blessed that this year I've been able to say I have never seen anything like blank quite a few times, but you know, this is even down to Emma Stone. It's just this is an entirely original kind of acting. it really is.
And it's just so possessed of wonder as well. When she first sets forth in Lisbon after Ruffalo's fallen asleep and just wanders around, sees the sights, eats a tart, you know, has something to drink, follows some people, sees a fight. It just, it truly bespeaks just the sheer wonder of being alive in the world. Seeing it, and seeing it in a way, and portraying it in a way that makes us feel like we're seeing a world for the first time. It's it's gorgeous.
Remarkable work.
A real treat.
Bella!
Oh.
Ah, right. Well, customarily, we do end, although I am hoping for a little contribution from a certain somebody. But before that, let's just have a little look at the highest grossing films of the year, because we do often have a little look. So it's a very interesting year. So there are a couple of reliable things in there. In fact, quite a bit of it is fairly reliable, but it's subtly different in a way that's quite pleasing. So at number 10, you have The Little Mermaid, which is the only Disney live-action film to feature. And there are no animated films from Disney. Wish, Elemental, all underperformed.
Really?
So
that's good.
So although there are more Disney movies in here, this is the only sort of, you know, Disney movie, if you get my meaning, that is featured
here.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's fine for me because I haven't seen The Little Mermaid and won't.
Probably won't. It's fine. Fine not to. Yeah. As you'd probably expect, the original is better, because the problem with that movie is the same as all of the other live action movies they've made. Remakes.
They're bad.
Then you've got The Wandering Earth 2, which looks like a very propagandary Chinese science fiction film about, hey, if we all work together and pitch in, we can create crazy sci-fi things in the future. And it's all very collective effort kind of stuff.
Very obvious. Yeah,
fairly straightforward. I should see it, though. I should see the ninth highest grossing film of the year. You know, even if it is.
If you applied that to number 10, you'd just be angry.
I did. Number 8 is Wonka. And Warner Brothers had a mixed year with their superhero movies all floundering, but then, well, they made Barbie, so I think they're okay.
Yeah.
Then the only other Chinese film was Full River Red, which is actually Zhang Yimou. And I had a look at the trailer. It looks quite fun. It looks like two members of a city guard are sent out to solve a crime. So it's kind of like a murder thing. But
okay,
with
that's
the production richness that you would want from a Yimou film. So I just
lovely. Yeah, because we watched the first, I'm going to say, 7 minutes of The Great Wall this year, and it didn't watch any more.
Yeah, fair enough. There's no reason to do that. Please don't do that, folks at home. Number six, Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, which was very much needed for Sony. It's their only big hit of the year, and I'm thrilled to see that that succeeded in all that it did. And it's also the first big, although I don't know about the two Chinese films, but this is the first big screen format film that did well this year, and there were quite a few more.
Yay.
Yeah.
Let's hope that that Venom 3 delivers in the same way.
Oh, boy. Sony. Fast X, Universal had a staggering year because three of the top five are Universal, so Fast X is the first of those.
I have not seen Fast X.
I don't know. I have a complicated relationship with those movies in as much as I don't like them. Actually, it's not that complicated.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no. Now I say it out loud. Yeah. Yeah, there are some of them that I am happy to watch, and the rest are disappointing. And I think since Hobbs and Shaw, I haven't seen one because that was bad.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just the whole thing is meant to be. It's so stupid. But there were only a couple of moments in there where I really laughed at how audaciously ridiculous what was happening is. If I want audaciously ridiculous, I'll go see The Sweet East. Thank you very much. Right. Sir. Right, number four is Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, the only sort of Marvel movie to have made the top 10 of the three that they released last year.
Mm. Oh, yeah. Well, that's good. But I had a lot of fun watching that. And I enjoyed myself very much, so I don't feel too bitter about that.
No, and I'm very happy that the only two superhero movies of the year that made the top 10 are the two ones that I enjoyed. So maybe audiences are getting more discerning. Although, if we looked at a slightly larger list, I imagine Ant-Man and Wasp would be fucking in there as well.
Yeah.
Number three, Oppenheimer. Brilliant. Excellent. Love that.
Yep.
Number two, the Super Mario Brothers movie. Probably the only heartbreak of this list. But you know what? It's interesting because... Yeah, because it's the only, apart from The Little Mermaid, the only really family-friendly movie to have made the top 10, and usually those are surefire. Yeah, so true. I hope those audiences aren't becoming isolated, but also I would love for them to go see other stuff, like robot games.
Yeah, or at the very least, Across the Spider-Verse, and what I assume is the highest grossing.
Number one is indeed Barbie. Which is a wonderful thing. It's wonderful to have a female-directed and female-focused sort of movie right there at the number one highest-grossing films of the year. It's really quite encouraging. I'm sure Hollywood will learn all the wrong lessons from it. But nevertheless, that's not a very depressing top 10 list. There are movies that aren't terribly good, but in terms of general trends, it does suggest that maybe we're approaching the end of certain really tiresome sort of box office trends, because audiences might just be getting curious about different types of movie. We can hope.
Or at the very least, bored of the existing types.
But you know, if my degree has taught me anything, it really is just the top 10 highest grossing films of the year is such a narrow sort of scope of what film can be. I mean, films that make no money whatsoever that are made with government money and only ever show in art installations are just as valid and interesting and exciting and worth talking about as these fucking ridiculous things. But you do want more people to see the good films. As a film critic, that's always been my thing, is you want more people to come and see the good films so that the conversation can grow and so that potentially new filmmakers can take influence from these films. Yeah. So it's well worth engaging with whatever is big. But guys, folks, get out there and see some weird stuff. If either of us have mentioned a film that you've never heard of, give it a go.
Just give it a go, because it might be good.
It might be.
Yeah, I've always seen the highest grossing, the top 10 list when we cover it every year as just like it's an afterthought where we talk about a TV show that has no bearing in reality. It just seems like such a distant alien phenomenon. And now the humor part of the show, where we just look at this nonsense.
Look at this.
So, it's but it is nice to see, but it is nice to see, you know, movies from our top 30s getting in there, and it was just indicative, I think, of the general high caliber of movies this year.
It was an extraordinary year, and I want big movies to be good. I just do. Because
me too.
It's how I got into cinema, and it's still the bit I really like. So, here's hoping that good movies will continue to be good, with whatever ends up being my number one film of 2024, making lots and lots of money. Did we hear from Nell?
Nell? Did you send a thing? Oh.
Oh,
she forgot.
What?
What are your top three? Okay, third, Monster.
Monster. Love Monster.
Yes. Okay, what's your number two?
Love Monster, yes.
Two, Perfect Days.
Perfect Days, so good. What's number one going to be?
Oh, what's your number one?
Uh-oh.
Number one, Anatomy of a Fool.
Anatomy of a Fool. Oh my God, it's the best.
Yeah.
Yes. It's
so, so good.
Fabulous top three from Nell there.
I agree. Nell is amazing.
Nell is amazing, actually. And everyone at she home, please, please do write in with your top tens as well. And we might cover them in a Patreon episode. But for now, I think we better get the hell out of here. Paul, how could people Thanks, Nell. Paul, how could people find out about the stuff we're doing right now?
The stuff we're doing right now, such as gesticulating in very sweaty t-shirts, can all be covered very, very impeccably on Twitter and Facebook at OGT Pod. We put out the call for the OG team most of the time, and if you have a good thing to say about a bad movie, or indeed if you want to tell us your favorite movies of the year, give us your top 10 if you've got it, boyo, Foco, then we would love to know, and then we can rip it to shreds in front of everybody, in front of all of our friends, or say, yes, what a wonderful top 10. We won't rip it to shreds.
What a wonderful top 10.
What a wonderful Perfect Days.
I'm Paulie Armstrong.
I'm Pluie Goodman.
And remember, folks, the one good thing about 2023 is that if you think it didn't have any good movies in it, then the good news is you got a whole lot to see. Or you might just be a dick.
Oh, yeah.